before we dive into today's episode, I wanted to let you know that you can follow Chat Cemetery on Instagram and Twitter at Chat Cemetery. There are links to those in the show notes. You can also support the show on Patreon, where I will be releasing bonus content for this show and my other podcast, Welcome to Geekdom. You can support for as little as a dollar a month to get access to all of that content. You can also rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or Podchaser. Both are extremely helpful for the show, and now let's dive into today's episode. Hey everyone, Chat Cemetery is back. I'm your host, Deanna Chapman, and today I am joined by Drew Deitch. We are talking In the Tall Grass, and we're doing something a little different with this episode. We're going to talk about both the story and the movie in this one, because the story slipped by me when I was making my giant spreadsheet that all of the guests know about by now, and it was one that was put out on Kindle and then later collected in a Joe Hill collection, not a Stephen King collection. So that's why it slipped by me. But Drew, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well. You know, anytime, you know, if there's a corn story, or I guess now grass, I have to be brought on. I'm the foliage expert. You know, Creepshow, we had to do the weeds thing. So I like my role there. And, you know, yeah, it's totally understandable that you would miss this in the collection. Like you said, it was collected in a Joe Hill collection. And frankly, I would love to, we'll never know this, but I would love to know what the delineation is between what King did on the story and what Hill did on the story. Because having read some other Joe Hill stuff, I would not be surprised if it was like a 60-40 split favoring Joe Hill.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And you know, I was reading it, and I'm always one of those people who is absolutely terrible at telling who wrote what parts, because by the end of it, all of the stories that King has co-written have had enough of him in them to where I don't really notice like a tone shift or anything like that with the other writers like Peter Straub and Richard Chismar, and obviously, you know, Owen and Joe, but I'm either just not paying enough attention, which I paid attention to this one because I read it and then not immediately watched the movie, but watched the movie within like a couple hours after finishing the story. And It was one of those things where I was like, okay, I was reading it and I thought the story was a little strange. And I was like, okay, well, it's Stephen King. His short stories can get a little strange because I think he plays a little more with the kinds of stories he tells in his short story format versus the longer novels and things like that. But, you know, I've only read one or two Joe Hill novels, so I'm not as familiar with, you know, his style and his types of storytelling, although I did watch Nosferatu, and you know, that's its whole own thing. But as far as writing goes, I was like, yeah, this kind of just feels like a King thing to me.
Yeah, it's the short story, which I quite like, but I would not be surprised to find out if the kernel of the idea was Joe Hill's and Stephen King kind of extrapolated certain ideas. The idea, you know, the basic story being that this brother and sister are traveling across country. The sister is pregnant. She's 19. And on their journey, they stop and next to this beat down church, and they hear somebody in this field of tall grass, a kid screaming for help, and they go and investigate and then become lost inside the tall grass, which is exhibiting this sort of supernatural distancing of them. And I want to stay specifically on the story because the movie adds a whole nother element to it. But in the story, it is that the distance seems to keep changing, even if they don't move.
Yeah.
Like they seem to be getting farther away from the road, farther away from each other. And as a kernel of an idea, I think that's great. I think it's like a really simple, creepy idea to do in a short story. And when it's eventually revealed in the short story that the source, presumably, of all this weirdness is this strange obsidian-like black rock in the middle of this, somewhere in this field in the story, that seems to exhibit some kind of supernatural powers. It's implied that it's been here for millennia, yeah, like who knows how long. It's weird and it's creepy. And where the story goes eventually is extremely dark. And it reminds me, The King part of that it reminds me of is the short story. Is it called Survivor Type?
Yeah,
I think yes, because it has a very similar dark, twisted, I guess spoilers, cannibalistic ending. As that, I think it's an interesting thing. It's something that when we talk about the movie, I'll get into what I think they did right and what I think they were just doomed to fail with the movie. But as a short story idea, I think it's really fun and creepy and weird. And like you said, with King, it's a little bit more abstract, which he can often do in his short stories because he doesn't have to be beholden to some larger character narrative or some larger world building or anything. It can just be like, hey, this is a weird abstract idea. Let's play it out for a little bit and have fun with it.
Yeah, you know, he's done stuff like that plenty of times before. I think The Raft is a good example, too, of not really focusing too much on the characters, but more so focusing on what's going on around them. And with this one, you know, at the beginning of the story, we get a little background as to why Becky and Cal are driving across the country. And you don't get that in the movie right off the bat, but, you know, the story gives you a little more information and it doesn't focus on the same number of characters, let's put it that way, as the movie does. Mm. But I still think, you know, this is a small enough story where even if you only have a handful of characters, you don't need to know everything about them. Like the boy Tobin, for instance, we don't know his favorite color. We don't know what games he likes to play. We don't know what his life is like back home. We know the bare minimum for that family, you know, Tobin and his parents. And I think that is what makes it work, because you get this information, you kind of start caring about Becky at least and Cal, and then you're just kind of throwing them into this situation where they are trying to do the right thing and it goes terribly, terribly wrong. And, you know, you don't need an immense amount of background information. This isn't like getting to know the Losers Club or anything like that for this to work.
No, I mean, that's one of the great advantages of short story is that you can just have a nugget of an idea and be like, let's play that idea out. And as long as the nugget is compelling and you have, some kind of impetus for the reader to be like, okay, like here's a character or characters that I'm on board with. In this case, it's the, you know, brother and sister, Cal and Becky. I believe they're twins, right? Like, cause that's the whole thing that they keep saying in the story is that, oh, they, you know, they can finish each other's sentences. They think alike and all this kind of stuff. I can't remember if in specifically they were twins or not, but
they did give off that vibe though, because they were like, you know, oh, maybe Cal's a little too close to you kind of thing.
Yeah, well, we'll get to that, especially in the movie. So, you know, they're perfectly. I like that the story starts really kind of. It starts with the hook of, well, if you know, one of them hadn't turned down the AC or one of them hadn't turned off the radio, then they wouldn't have heard the kids screaming. But then it immediately goes into the background by with a scene between their parents. Mm-hmm. Talking about them and what's going on. And so it's like, okay, this gives us just enough of a foundation for characters so that when they get thrown into this wacky and terrifying premise, we have some establishment of a reason to care about what happens to them. But the story, I think it's only like a 40 pages or so. Mm-hmm. And what, like you were talking about with Tobin, in the story, Tobin pretty much just acts as an inciting incident, and then it's a twist revealing that actually he's a sinister presence in the story.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, that works. Fine. Cool. Great. Gravy. You know, the character of Tobin's dad, who we will definitely talk about in the movie, is extremely short-lived. Like, he's only there for a couple of pages and is, again, made to be a threatening presence and establish something that I think is actually better expounded upon in the movie. But, you know, the short story for anybody, you know, like I said, spoilers, they end up lost in this field. Cal is tempted by Tobin to touch this giant rock because he keeps saying, like, if you touch the rock, you'll know exactly where Becky is. You can find her and you'll know everything. Mm-hmm. And he is magnetically pulled towards the rock, which has these strange kind of ancient stick figure drawings of people on it. And, you know, again, to push home, it's like it's been here a long time. And once he does, it seems that he has been consumed by some kind of sinister force. He finds Becky, who has this extended dream sequence about losing a kid she was babysitting and all this kind of stuff. Which eventually ends up being a metaphorical thing for her own baby, because she gives birth in this field and is unbeknownst to her, fed her own child to survive.
It's brutal.
Yeah. I mean, and essentially that's the end of the story proper. There's like an epilogue where a band of weird hippies show up and get sucked into the field again. Like it's like, it will keep going on forever. Kind of ending.
Yeah, I want to talk about that ending real quick. Sorry to interrupt you.
That feels Stephen King. No, that ending feels extremely Stephen King.
Yes, I was like, I didn't need this.
It's bizarre because there's all these allusions to like Ken Kesey's The Merry Pranksters, and it's like their character names are like Ma and Pa Cool and Twista and Tony the Wiz or something. Like, this is Stephen King.
Yeah, honestly, and the line that it could have ended on, if they didn't add that sort of, it's only a page, so it's not even a lot. But, you know, the line right before that sequence is Becky DeMuth hugged the rock. And I feel like that would have been such a better ending. And, you know, I've talked a lot about King's endings on here because he will do things like add an epilogue that we didn't really need and things like that. And they're usually not super long, but you're like, okay, where you had ended it just before that was kind of perfect. But there are endings that I absolutely love, like Pet Sematary's ending, for instance. And, you know, it's hit or miss for a lot of people. I know it's a often talked about thing, but yeah, this, I was like,
he parodied himself in It Chapter Two when he showed, he's like, I don't like the endings. It's like, like it's a known factor with him.
Yeah. So that was kind of the slightly disappointing part with this story for me, but I really did enjoy this overall because, you know, it wasn't too long. It was one of those things that reminded me a little of N, because in N there are like these Stonehenge kind of stones, and if you take a photo, there's an extra one in it kind of thing, and it kind of messes with space and time in the same way that this does.
Interesting. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think if this had been in a collection and was like the last story in the collection and it left you on that, and specifically, like you said, it ended with, you know, Becky DeMuth hugged the rock, it'd be like, ooh, all right, I need to go like for a walk in the sunshine.
Yeah.
Like,
and then they just brought in like these wacky characters and you're like, but we don't care about them. So I don't want that.
It's an unnecessary epilogue, and it's completely excised in the movie appropriately, but also because the movie goes down a completely different path.
It really does. And, you know, Drew, do you have anything left on the story before we dive into the movie?
No, other than like, I like Joe Hill as well. You know, obviously talking about Stephen King a lot, but I've read a couple of Joe Hill's novels and short stories. I like the 20th Century Ghost collection quite a lot. And I'd say this is like, for Stephen King, this is pretty good. For Joe Hill, I'd say this is like one of the best things that I've read of his.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. And one of my biggest regrets with this podcast, and it's not like a huge regret, but just covering the collections the way I didn't get a chance to really like dive into each story. So, you know, I'm closing in on catching up here, and then I'm going to, you know, do a Stephen King cleanse and go read some other things first. And then maybe, you know,
you've earned it.
Dive back into some of the short stories that I maybe didn't pay as much attention to in the episodes, because I largely talked about, you know, the ones that had been adapted like this one, because those are obviously going to be the ones that people are more familiar with if they've had movie or TV show adaptations. So, you know, it's been quite the journey here, but let's talk about the movie, which is a whole different journey, Drew.
It really, so I was actually extremely hyped for this movie for the simple fact that it was being directed by Vincenzo Natali, who, for anybody who doesn't know, he directed the cult hit Cube, also directed a number of episodes of the television show Hannibal, and the movie Splice, which is one of those movies that I want to recommend to people, but it's also like, yeah, but it's extremely icky and weird, and I don't know if I can recommend it to you, but it's really good. So I was like, oh, great, new Vincenzo Natali adapting this short story that I quite liked. The only thing that I realized now that was probably working against the movie is that this is a Netflix film. Mm-hmm. And the reason I say that it works against it is that the Netflix audience, I have learned, has very particular expectations, and especially when it comes to what I think they like as horror. And as soon as it was like, oh yeah, it's going to be out on Netflix this weekend, and I started seeing the responses, I was like, yeah, this was not the right audience to like market this to, as you know what, you know, like all Netflix big releases, it was the banner thing across the platform when you open it up, so a lot of people just clicked it like that. And I think you know, the story is weird, but the way that Natali decided to adapt it and the things that he decided to focus on visually and with mood, this has got to be, it, if not one of, potentially the most surreal Stephen King horror movies I can think of.
Yeah, I know that you and I are probably a little differing in our opinions of this movie, but I think you're totally right that, you know, this wasn't the right audience for this. Like, if this had been something like a Shudder original, for instance, I think that platform and that audience, frankly, would have been much better suited for this. And, you know, that's not to say that Gerald's Game was a mistake for Netflix, and that was
not the right
audience. But those, like Gerald's Game as a Netflix original and In the Tall Grass as a Netflix original, are two very, very different movies still. It doesn't matter that they're both Stephen King adaptations. It's just, you know, the styles are totally different. And obviously Mike Flanagan now has quite the relationship with Netflix and, you know, the horror stuff that he does for them. But, you know, with In the Tall Grass, I was a little worried because it is an hour and 40 minutes, which I do think was a little too long for this, given that it was a 40-page story. And, you know,
well, yeah, I mean, yeah, you find out why, because they pretty much cover the short story in about the first half hour or so, and then the story becomes something completely new and different, and the elements that are added make it, I mean, it is still essentially the same story, but it becomes but when they make that turn, it's like, all right, things are extremely different as far as motivation and the concepts that we're having to deal with.
And I'll admit, I think that's where it lost me a little bit, because in the short story, you know, baby daddy Travis is mentioned twice within like the same paragraph, and that's it.
And only once by name, yeah.
Yeah. So you have this very brief mention of him in the story, and he becomes such a big part of this movie. And while I do think some of it works because it kind of brings more of Cal's sort of darker personality out with regards to like his feelings towards his sister and things like that, so I think it does work fairly well. But at the same time, you know, we're getting more focus on Ross and especially Tobin, and Tobin's mom comes into play a little more. It just didn't come together for me. It felt a little too repetitive at times. And I think because of the runtime, you know, that was bound to happen, especially once I was like you said, 30 minutes in, and I was like, so what now?
Well, because here's the big conceptual change that they make from the short story to the movie is that in the short story, it is pretty much only distance that is affected in the field, that people, they just continually get farther apart or whatever. In the movie, that is true, but the other thing that gets affected is time. time becomes affected in the field in weird ways. And this turns into essentially an alternate multiple branching timeline story. And that is weird. Like in all honesty, I like the movie, but I will admit that adding this time element to it is a little bit of a hat on top of a hat.
Yeah.
It definitely screws. I mean, even when I was watching, I was like, okay, so like, and this is the second time I've seen the movie. I was like, oh, right. I guess these are just alternate branches of time that we're seeing and things kind of keep repeating over and over. And I think that's a really easy way to lose an audience. Especially when it's presented in such a surreal fashion where, you know, dreams are happening in weird ways and are the dreams reality, that kind of stuff is just going to mess with you on top of having this weird, well, now we're dealing with alternate time stuff where it's like, you know, when Travis, the boyfriend, shows up after we've spent some time with Becky and Cal in the field, and he goes in and he meets Tobin, but Tobin already knows who he is. And then later he runs into Tobin again and Tobin doesn't know who he is because time is all wonky. Mm-hmm. It's like, yeah, I can see this being extremely hard to wrap your head around. I think, again, I like the movie quite a bit, but I admit that that's going to be a problem. The one thing I will champion the movie for is and it's something, again, that I was excited for when it was announced, is that I think Natalie's direction is incredible considering he is pretty much stuck to a, you know, repeating visual location, just people standing around in tall grass. Yeah. I think he does some really cool visual stuff in this.
I did like it when he broke it up to introduce Travis. Basically, you know, you see him pull up at the gas station and the lady comes out and kind of gives him this look and points at the no smoking sign. And, you mm-hmm. know, it's just a few things like that, or even when they make it to the old bowling alley. And, you know, it gives you that little reprieve from all of these scenes in the tall grass and the mud and, you know, having these weird visuals come up. And I think that helped with the pacing a little bit, at least. But, you know, I totally get why people would like this movie. I just think the whole time element, it just wasn't for me. I was like, okay, here we go. All right, they're not going to know anything.
It becomes deliberately repetitive, like you said. Like, we'll see the same scene 3 times, but then something changes, and you're like, all right, like, it can feel like you're getting a sense of stalling. And for me, I enjoy the idea of, like, well, let's revisit the same scenario, but now something's different about it. What changes? And, you know, to the point of direction, like, I think there's very cool surreal images in here, like Becky dreaming or seeing the image of her fetus being, you know, consumed by grass. You know, there's so much in the movie that adds on to what was present in the story, like the idea that the grass is possibly somehow sentient. Like, that it's, you know, not in like the ooh evil grass way. It's like,
yeah.
No, it's an extension of the rock in some way. You know, there's great moments when the wind will be blowing. The one moment I love is when the wind's blowing and then all of a sudden the grass is swaying and then it just stops and everything stops. It's like, that's fun, cool, creepy imagery. The kind of weird dream sequence stuff, or like when somebody touches the rock and the sky explodes into this, you know, water drop of blood and things like that. It's like, yeah, like I like this a lot from a visual standpoint, but it's all mixing in weird symbolism and stuff. And that is not what people on a Friday night when they're checking their Netflix want to see as far as a horror movie experience goes. They want something that's a little bit more straightforward. I think there's still things I think one of the absolute best things about the movie is Patrick Wilson's performance as the villain. He's having a ball.
Yeah, the cast is good in this. And, you know, the actress who plays Becky is actually also in Lock and Key.
Oh, okay.
So that was just a fun little tie to, you know, another Joe Hill thing there. And that's something that always intrigues me when people kind of return to certain properties mm-hmm. or, you know, certain people's IP, because we've seen it happen so, so often with Stephen King stuff. And, you know, sometimes it's like decades in between appearances, like, you know, Sissy Spacek playing Carrie in the 70s and then coming back for Castle Rock in the 2010s. That's like a huge gap. But, you know, it's just so fun to make those connections. And the cast does a really nice job. And I will say that, Drew, you and I have talked about quite a few movies here that were not great and also did not like look great. So I want to credit this movie with the cinematography and just the way it looked, because it was really, really well shot.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's so many cool moments taken out of the context of the movie that I think are cool. Like there's this whole weird dream idea sequence of what I assume is all the different people over generations that have, you know, succumbed to the Black Rock and been a sacrifice. They're showing up as these weird grass vortex face people. And there's a shot where Becky is the one seeing this, and it's this bird's eye view of what's, it looks like both the people, but then the people are also the field, and they're doing this weird undulation as they're chanting uh-huh. and they're like moving Becky closer to the rock. It's an awesome image. And again, Natalia is just a great director with this kind of weird, surreal horror, and knows how to make stuff look really good. His productions always look exceptionally great. And again, like I said, Patrick Wilson is just, he gets an amazing head squish in this movie. I want to point out, I'd forgotten that. The head squish moment is fantastic. He's extremely creepy, extremely fun. And my favorite thing in terms of adding upon the story is actually his moment when he first brings them to the rock and starts talking about it. Because in the story, that never happens. His character in the story has already like touched the rock and has been driven crazy by it and stuff, and he exits pretty quickly. But in this one, he's a recurring villain who has some idea of like, yeah, you all keep coming back here and weird whatever this weird time stuff is going on, and I keep killing you over and over again. But the thing that I love that's added is something that I think speaks to a better understanding of maybe what the story could have been hinting at. When he brings them to the rock, he talks about, you know, we're in the center of the United States. This is probably the center of the center, essentially saying like this dark thing is the heart of the United States. And that adds a lot of really interesting subtext and metaphor and stuff to what's like, okay, well, what is this dark heart that people have been sacrificed to over and over? Of course, there's a church nearby, so it brings in ideas of religion. But what I like is that in the story, they mention this, but I don't think they draw attention to it. The characters don't in the movie, is that the church is called the Black Rock of the Redeemer. Yeah. And in the story, like Becky's just like, ah, you know, we're in Kansas. That's something weird. They show the sign in the movie, but I'm like, yeah, I like that it's not necessarily directly Christianity. Obviously there's strong Christian overtones, but it is talking about that, yes, there is some weird dark heart of religion that people have been sacrificed to and get lost in the field of that manipulates them. And it's like when that line that's not in the book, but in the story, but is in the movie about him saying this is the center of the United States. It's like, okay, now we have something more strongly thematic going on here than necessarily what was in the story. So I liked that addition quite a lot, but I think the big buy-in for the movie that is the make or break idea is the idea that yes, it's not just that they're getting warped around in time. Apparently they are now stuck in some kind of eternally branching alternate timeline thing. The shot where Ross, Patrick Wilson's character, kills Cal, and Cal looks over and sees his own corpse. And then the camera dollies back and we see multiple corpses. It's like, oh, okay, I guess he's been killing them over and over again. Like I said, I can enjoy that, but I totally acknowledge, hat on a hat. This is like it's a little too much to have to swallow for what's already a weird movie.
Yeah, I do want to talk about this ending too, because it kind of brings everything into play and sort of everything full circle as far as, you know, the time and space and what's going on. So
I would say something, you know, that we mentioned that Travis comes in as a character, you know, about 30 or 40 minutes into the movie.
Yeah.
Something that I will admit is a problem with the movie is that that creates a protagonist shift. And unfortunately, Travis is not as interesting a protagonist as Becky was. And Becky was kind of, Cal and Becky were set up as co-protagonists, but we spend a lot more time in Becky's head from her perspective in the movie. So it was kind of like, okay, Becky's becoming our protagonist and she's pregnant. So we immediately have an additional worry. It's not just her life, but you know, her baby's life that we're worried about. And then the shift to Travis kind of becomes the protagonist once he enters the story.
Yeah, absolutely.
While he's not bad, and the actor that's playing him, I can't remember his name, but he was also in Upgrade. His character's just not as interesting. And he eventually becomes a little bit of a plot donkey. He's got to learn every single thing and how the rules work and all that kind of stuff. And he does eventually... He eventually is the one that is going to be able to get Becky and Cal to survive. Like, he decides to touch the rock because touching the rock will allow you to navigate the field. But in that way, you're stuck in the field. You're never going to leave it. So he does. He touches the rock. He gives Tobin, I think it was like a necklace that Becky had, and gives it to him and gets Tobin out. And not only gets him out of the field, but puts him in the moment in time just before Cal and Becky entered the field.
Yeah, there definitely is a shift as soon as he comes into the picture. And, you know, with the ending, we're back where the movie essentially started a few minutes after. Becky and Cal are on the side of the road. Tobin comes running out of the church while he is also yelling to them from the field. So not only does it shift time, but it's allowing Tobin to exist in two places at once. And then it just kind of ends after that. And you're like, okay, all right.
Yeah, I mean, Tobin, I mean, does he exist? Like, what? We don't really understand where the field exists in time and space.
True.
Like it's its own universe in a sense. Because I was thinking this time, I was like, why didn't he send Tobin back to meet himself? Like, can stop his family from going in, because then that would also stop Cal and Becky from going in. Or maybe they wouldn't, you know, because they, I think they mention in the story and in the movie that they heard a woman crying for help when they got in. Or no, was it just that their dog ran into the field? Because there's a scene in the movie where we see them stopping. And I think they hear a woman or somebody else crying for help too.
Yeah, I think they hear something because Tobin starts walking towards like the edge of the parking lot for all that's worth. It's basically just a dirt lot. But, you know, he's with his dog, Freddy, and his mom, and Ross is on the phone. And then Freddy just takes off into the field in the movie. And, you know, I think it's kind of implied that if they didn't hear it, the dog was hearing something at least.
Right. Yeah. So yes, Tobin shows up and Tobin's able to stop Cal and Becky from going in and save them. And the other big thing, because this is really what I felt the story was about, and the movie, this is a thread of what it's about. It is about the fear of motherhood, of parenting. And in the book, obviously, that is taken to an extremely dark ending, which we get in this. Like, they do the whole baby eating scene in the movie, but it's in one of the abandoned timelines, apparently. You know, one of the timelines that we see. So, the fear of young motherhood, of being a parent at a young age and just being a parent, that's what this whole symbolism of her driving, you know, so far cross country to do this. And then when this ending happens and Tobin shows up and stops it there, she makes the decision to turn back, essentially implying that she's going to go back to where Travis is, that they're going to try and have this family together. At the same time, we see Travis in the field, you know, pretty weakened, but knowing that they got out is happy, and then collapses and presumably dies, is consumed by the field. So like that thematic through line is there. I don't think it's the most interesting thing in the movie or the most like expounded upon, because it has all of this other weird sci-fi fantasy stuff that it's trying to do. But yes, the movie also does just kind of end. Like, we see Travis there. He's consumed by the field and then just fade to black. And Creedence Clearwater Revival starts rocking. I like this movie, but I'm also extremely, like, prepped to like it because of the director. He's done other very kind of surreal horror stuff in the past. But my big thing, you know, knowing why, because I looked up the reputation, and it does not have a good reputation at all. And I think it's because, like we said, yeah, it was a Netflix Friday horror movie, and people were proud. And especially when you put the name Stephen King on it, it's like people were like, oh, yeah, I loved it. It's like, this ain't that. Like,
no, not at all.
It's not a crowd pleaser. It's extremely dark. It's extremely weird. You know, like you said, if it had been on Shudder, or like if this had been like an A24 horror movie, you know, where it was directed more towards like an artier outlet and audience, yeah, I think maybe its reception would have been slightly better. As it stands, I think it's a very well-made movie. I think the decision to add this whole other element of, well, now we're going to, it essentially becomes a very different story after a point when it realizes that, well, we're messing with time too. And I think it does that in cool ways too. There's a shot where like Travis, when he first enters the field, is walking and the sun's in front of him. And then he's like, what the heck? The sun just disappeared. And he turns around and it's behind him. And there's like cuts to night and everything. And of course, them hearing, you know, each other in different times and stuff. It's like, I like that stuff. Granted, I'm also somebody who liked the recent Blair Witch movie, which did very similar stuff.
Okay.
Where, you know, there's moments where they're like, wait a minute, it was just, like, we just ran into you and it was just daytime. Or they send a drone up to see how far into the forest they are, and the forest just goes on forever. It's like, oh, those kind of ideas creep me out. I guess this is, I'll add some personal thing to this. It's like, I'm not a camper. I'm not a guy that's like, oh yeah, go out in the wilderness, because I have an intense fear of being lost in the wilderness.
Valid fear.
Like, not... Like, cause I'm terrible with direction anyways. Mm-hmm. I have a very poor sense of direction. So going in somewhere that is like, the odds are stacked against you that you can lose what direction you're going, is like, ooh, I like that kind of stuff really creeps me out. And so I love seeing it in horror. If nothing else, I do think the movie satisfies the short story, cause it essentially does, you know, 90% of what's in the short story. But I think the decision to go further with it, and the way that it decided to go further, is kind of a make or break decision. Like, it's a big buy-in already to accept, like, they're in this weird field that distances them in weird supernatural ways, and now we're throwing time on top of it. It's a tough sell.
Honestly, what I think I would really love to see is for them to bring back sort of the anthology series. Obviously, Creepshow is a thing that exists, but that has a very specific level of campiness to it.
Right. The tone is very specific.
Yeah. So I would love for them to do something along the lines of like Nightmares and Dreamscapes again, where, yes, that still had campiness to it too, but I think, you know, there's a way to do stuff like that, or Cat's Eye, and have a little more of a serious tone and cover these kinds of stories that way, because I think a lot of it for me was the length and just how much they strayed from the story. I think, you know, there's definitely a version of this that sort of just covers the story and cuts the epilogue. Not that it's called an epilogue, but, you know, that last little section there that I think I personally would have enjoyed more. But, you know, I gave this a 2.5 out of 5. It wasn't as bad as some of the other things you and I in particular have watched by any means. It looked good.
No, I mean, yeah, we've all survived the Mangler too, so.
And 3.
That's true. Yeah. Oh, God. See, it's so bad I forgot that we did the Mangler 3.
Yeah. Yeah. Easy to forget.
Well, I mean, I don't know if I might have said this on the show multiple times, but if so, I think it bears repeating, is that as a Stephen King fan, I'm actually more of a fan of his short fiction.
Okay.
You know, there are plenty of novels of his that I like, but I love his short fiction, and it's always been the most inspiring to me as somebody who loves horror and loves fiction. Is like, I've written short stories that, you know, are directly inspired because of how I felt about Stephen King's short fiction. And so I would love for there to be an avenue of adaptation that was more conducive to just doing his short story. And there's certainly been adaptations. Like, there's the grandma episode of, I believe it was Tales from the Dark Side, or no, I think it was the Twilight Zone. The 80s Twilight Zone did that.
Yeah, there's some of that stuff that I haven't included yet either, because I'm like, okay, this is, you know, something within something else, and I will get to that eventually. But, you know, like I said with the novella, some of that stuff just sort of slipped by me because it wasn't like in the specific areas I was looking when creating the spreadsheet. So I was like, oh, I missed a few adaptations because they were single episodes of these other, you know, TV shows. So I do have plans to go back and check out those sorts of things. And then you have like Mercy, which was loosely based on Grandma. So I'm very curious to see like how certain things play out in a shorter format, because Mercy was another one I did not enjoy.
No, I mean, I'm a big booster for the 80s Twilight Zone show, and I've seen that Grandma episode, and it's a very kind of straightforward, fun idea, while still, you know, getting across the horror of it, which is like, oh yeah, taking care of a dying relative, something that clearly is in Stephen King's mind a lot, you know, because infamously Zelda from Pet Sematary is a big part of that. Yeah. But I definitely like, if there was an episode of, you know, there was like 30, 40 minutes of In the Tall Grass that just did the short story, and it was, you know, by the same team, by the same director, it'd be like, yeah, that was a really creepy, effective, well-made thing. It's certainly like, as somebody who likes the movie, I say it's an overcomplicated idea. I like the complications, but it is deniably overcomplicated. And so maybe, you know, with all Stephen King projects always getting announced, it would be nice. Like you said, I know Creepshow's there and he has that attachment to it, but for the most part, Creepshow stays pretty tonally consistent in being, we want to do fun, wacky, goopy kind of stories. It would be cool to have something, like you said, like Nightmares and Dreamscapes that they tried to do, something that was adapting King short stories, just as short stories, is like, hey, you know, it's 20. And in the modern age, what I love is that because a lot of things don't have to be beholden to broadcast limits, it can be like, hey, a story can be 20 minutes, or it can be 40 minutes, or it could be 12. Like, whatever feels right. What's the necessary length to tell this? Like Netflix has the anthology show Love, Death, and Robots. And those, you know, not every short's great, but every short feels exactly as long as it was intended to be. And I think that would be something like, if it was just Stephen King stuff, where it's like, we're just doing Stephen King short stories and letting, you know, young filmmakers adapt them in different ways. Maybe some are done in animation, maybe some are done live action. I think that'd be an awesome idea. I would be so on board with that. And I would not be against something like In the Tall Grass getting another swing at it in that format.
Yeah. And, you know, the downside with Nightmares and Dreamscapes was that it was on network television. I think it was on like TNT or something. So it did have those specific restrictions as far as, you know, what they were willing to show and the length. So.
Well, just the way that you have to write, because you have to write for commercial breaks. Yeah. So it's like, you know, you have to have specific act breaks that end certain ways to tease people to come back after the commercials. Whereas in streaming, it's like, no, you can just tell the whole story in one go, like it would be if you were reading it. So, yeah, I mean, I would love to see that, you know, considering as Stephen King projects continue to get greenlit and continue to get made. I actually think that would be one of the coolest things that's, you know, like we said, Creepshow's there, but it's never been done where it was like the selling point is we're doing all Stephen King stories and they're all going to be different.
Yeah.
Like, you know, different filmmakers, different formats, different tones. Like, you can have something that's more funny and then the next one be something really grim and dark and creepy. You know, hey, Netflix, hit us up. We've just got, give us like $100 million like you're giving everybody else apparently to make these things.
Yeah, we have some good ideas here.
Yeah. And you know, just pay us for them.
Lots of untapped Stephen King short stories.
It's true. I mean, well, it's interesting, you know, on this topic, they're getting to the point now where they're spinning stuff off in larger ways, like that Chapelwaite show, which is like a spinoff of the short story Jerusalem's Lot.
Yes, which is only like 30 pages and Chapelwaite is 10 episodes. I'm actually watching that right now and I'm just like, okay.
But if there was a Stephen King anthology show, it's like, hey, you can just do the short story and you can have your own take on it, obviously. You don't want it to just be a one-to-one adaptation, but there's some stuff it's like, yeah, you don't need to make it into a feature film. Yeah. You don't need to make it into a 40-minute episode of something when if the story was 8 pages, like do it in 10. Like do it in 10 minutes and tell a fun little story. And like I'll say it again, is like if that came around and somebody did In the Tall Grass and kind of just did the short story, I'd be cool with it. I'd watch that.
Yeah, because like you said, not too much was missing. Maybe the conversation with the parents at the beginning of the novella is something you could add in and just, you know, make it differentiate itself from the Netflix version that we did get. But Drew, I know you rated this a little higher than I did. So I love that you enjoyed it.
I'm extremely biased in favor of the director, and I'm very used to this particular brand of surreal horror, and I like it because for me, if you can craft strong visual images that I will remember, that goes a really long way. And I think as a visual experiment, I think In the Tall Grass is pretty darn good. Mm-hmm. Like I think it creates some really cool images and concepts and stuff. In terms of the cinematography, in terms of the filmmaking and the storyboarding and stuff like that. And that goes a long way for me. And I do like how extremely weird it gets. But again, as I said, I recognize it's too much. Like it's too weird, but sometimes I like too weird, in the right hands. So, but yes, it's always fun when we have differing opinions on the subject. You know, as long as everybody out there still likes Children of the Corn 3, which, you know, Children of the Corn 3, if you watch one Stephen King foliage, you know, like related thing based off of this podcast, please watch Children of the Corn 3 Urban Harvest.
It sure is something. That's for sure. Yeah. You'll get a Charlize Theron cameo.
Look, if a stop motion corn monster showed up and In the Tall Grass, I would have bumped that up to 5 stars. So. I'm just saying.
That is completely fair. But Drew, thank you so much for joining me to discuss this one. And thank you for being willing to discuss the story in addition to the movie. That was kind of a last minute decision on our part. And, you know, so a little out of chronological order here with this episode, but I think that's okay.
That's okay. You know, it's a bonus. You're getting a 2-for-1, everybody. And as always, Deanna, I'm always stoked and happy to be on here. Next time there's some plant or grass or oriented thing, you know where I'm at. So just hit me up.
Yeah, maybe one day someone is going to adapt the plant and finish it with their own ending.
There we go. Zing. Got you, Big Steve.
We'll end on that note.